Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director here, and this evening I'm delighted to welcome you all to the to hear Steve Hadley deliver the annual Owen Harries Lecture. Let me begin by acknowledging Owen Harries, who is in the audience tonight with Dorothy, and who, in whose honour Stephen is speaking. Owen is a dear friend to many of us at the Institute. He has had an illustrious career which spanned many years. He was an advisor to the Fraser government. He was Australia's ambassador to UNESCO, and he was the founding editor of The National Interest. He has been a non-resident fellow here at the Institute for more than a decade. We established this lecture last year in order to recognise Owen's magnificent contribution to our field and his decade-long association with us here at Bligh Street. It is an annual address delivered by a prominent commentator on global affairs, and it's fitting that this year the Owen Harries Lecture will again be given by our distinguished international fellow. Let me tell you a little bit about that fellowship, and then I'll introduce this year's fellow. The Telstra Distinguished International Fellowship is an initiative from the Institute to bring an internationally recognised intellectual and policy leader to Australia. It's part of our commitment to thickening the foreign policy debate in our country. And what we do with this, which is a little different from other visits, there's a lot of visits where somebody comes in, gives a speech in Sydney and then leaves, or maybe gives a speech in Sydney and Melbourne. But what we do with this is something different. We bring them to Australia for 2 or 3 weeks. We embed them in the Institute. We take them to Canberra. We take them to Sydney. They meet with the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister, the Defence Minister, the Opposition Leader, senior Cabinet Ministers, CEOs. They spend a lot of time with our staff here, with our young researchers and our more experienced researchers. So we hope that they bring their insights to us so we can learn from them. But we also hope that they go home knowing a little bit about Australia, knowing a lot about Australia. And they go home, as it were, as envoys for Australia. The principal sponsor of the Distinguished International Fellowship is Telstra, a wonderful corporate member of the Institute. And I thank them, and in particular David Thodey, who's taken a personal interest in the fellowship, for their support. Ladies and gentlemen, this year we're honoured to have Steve Hadley as our 2014 Telstra Distinguished International Fellow. Steve is one of the smartest analysts in Washington. He is also a reminder of an earlier, and I think somewhat gentler, era of collegiality and bipartisanship. He has had a 40-year career inside and outside of government. He started on Henry Kissinger's staff on Gerald Ford's National Security Council. He later served as an Assistant Secretary for Defence under President George H.W. Bush. Under George W. Bush, he was Deputy National Security Advisor in the first term and National Security Advisor from 2005 to 2009. These days, he is a principal of Rice Hadley Gates, a consulting firm he founded with two other little-known American public servants, Condoleezza Rice and Bob Gates. He is also board chairman of the United States Institute of Peace, which at this time, in this era of conflict, is probably a very difficult job. As an illustration of the bipartisan regard in which Steve is held, President Obama consulted him before announcing his strategy to counter the Islamic State last month. He has deep knowledge on the Middle East, on Asia, on Europe and Russia, and indeed as the person who stood at the right hand of the President of the United States for many years, he is somebody from whom we can learn an enormous amount. He has said to me that he is sometimes in danger of being Democrats' favourite Republican, which is a dangerous position to be in. Let me also say that after 2 weeks in this country, he is in danger of being Australians' favourite American. Because on top of being one of the smartest people in Washington, he's one of the nicest people in Washington. He's enormously generous with his time, collegial as well as insightful. So, Steve, it has been an honour and a pleasure to work with you over the past fortnight. This evening, Steve will be talking about the United States, China, and the new model of great power relations. This is President Xi Jinping's intriguing conceptualizations of one of the most important bilateral relationships in the world. That bilateral relationship is crucial to global stability, but the contours of the relationship are very unclear. No one is better qualified to describe those contours than Stephen Hadley. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Hadley.
Michael, thank you very much. It always bothers me when he says that bit about nice guy, because you know what they say, you know, nice guys finishing last and all of that. But thank you very much for that generous introduction. And I want to thank Telstra and the Lowy Institute for the opportunity to come here for 2 weeks and try to learn a little bit about Australia and see the world a little bit through Australian eyes. And it has been a real honor and a privilege. I've learned a lot, and I've had a great time. And I just want to thank you very much for the opportunity. And I'd like to thank you all for coming out tonight on this rainy evening. So let's begin. In June of this year, I gave a speech on the new model of Sino-US major power relations at the World Peace Forum in Beijing, China. And in that speech, I tried to describe the basic characteristics of this new model of relations, the reasons for thinking it might be achieved, why the effort might fail, and what steps could be taken to increase the likelihood of success. The speech seemed to be well received by both the Americans and the Chinese in the audience, and I want to draw heavily on it tonight. And then I want to discuss what really has to happen if the promise of a new model is to be realized. And then finally, I want to discuss an alternative model coming out of Moscow that I fear may have some attraction for Chinese leaders. And then I hope we can talk about this a little bit at the end. It was President Xi Jinping, as Michael pointed out, that first proposed a new model of great power or major country relations. And President Obama agreed that the two countries should seek both to develop the principles of this new model of relations, but also to operationalize those principles in concrete and practical cooperation of mutual benefit to both nations. Historically, when a new major power has emerged on the world stage, it has usually resulted in confrontation and conflict between that new power and the existing major powers. And of course, the example most cited is the First World War, which most scholars attribute to the rise of Germany and the challenge that presented to Great Britain. President Obama and President Xi want to make sure that China's dramatic rise as a major global power does not provoke a similar confrontation and conflict between China and the United States. So why do these two leaders think they can break the historical pattern? There are several reasons. First, some of the factors that fueled past confrontation and conflict between major powers are simply not present between China and the United States. For example, there are no conflicting territorial claims between them, and neither country has traditional colonial aspirations. The United States has not tried to prevent China's emergence on the world stage, but has in fact facilitated it through robust trade and investment, support for China's diplomatic entry, and contributing to the stable geopolitical environment in Asia. For its part, China has so far accepted the existing global diplomatic, financial, and economic institutions, recognizing that they have in fact contributed to the economic success and increasing prosperity of China. Second factor, several things that are present in the relationship between China and the United States that were less prominent in the relationship between the major powers of the past, give us some grounds for thinking that we can achieve a new model here. What are these items? Let me give you an example. Our two nations are increasingly interconnected and interdependent economically, financially, and in terms of trade. This gives them an incentive to resolve disputes without the resort to confrontation or military force. Indeed, military conflict would threaten the very interrelationships on which the prosperity and security of both countries depends. And as China's economy has grown and become more integrated into the world economy and financial system, it has in fact become more receptive to freer trade, more open investment, greater protection of intellectual property, and a currency more responsive to market forces. This development has increased the likelihood of greater cooperation between the two countries and the prospects of avoiding confrontation and conflict. But perhaps the biggest reason to be cautiously optimistic that the two countries can break the traditional pattern is because it is very much in each of their interest to do so. If either country is to achieve its stated hopes for future security and prosperity, they will simply have to cooperate and work together. For both countries are threatened by a wide array of global challenges on which progress simply has to be made if either country is to remain prosperous and secure. Now, the list of these global challenges is a long one and familiar to all of us. A weakened global financial system, inadequate global job creation, growing environmental damage, air and water pollution, potential health pandemics, food, water, and energy resources that are insecure and inadequate, terrorism, proliferation, transnational crime. It is a long, long list. And these are challenges that neither China nor the United States can solve alone. Progress can only be made if China and the United States work together with other nations to help find solutions. And traditional major country confrontation and conflict would make such cooperation impossible. So, what are the principles on which this new model of major country relations could be based? President Xi Jinping has put forward a three-point proposal as a basis for the new model of relations. No confrontation or military conflict. Mutual respect. Seeking cooperation and, as the Chinese say, win-win outcomes. Not a bad start, but it is only a start. The two countries need to make a concerted effort to develop a set of principles that could underpin the new model and guide relations between China and the United States going forward. I would offer you my list for consideration of these principles. Acceptance by the United States of the peaceful rise of China as a global power and its hopes for peaceful development. Acceptance by China of a continued U.S. role as a stabilizing presence in the Asia-Pacific. Mutual recognition that the prosperity and success of each nation is in the best interests of the other. Mutual recognition that each nation's success is not zero sum, but win-win. That is, the success of the United States can contribute to the success of China, and the success of China can contribute to the success of the United States. Commitment by the two countries that the foundation of their relationship will be constructive patterns of cooperation based on mutual interest, mutual benefit, and mutual respect. And finally, the principle of acting together to manage areas of continuing difference or dispute so that they do not undermine cooperation or degenerate into confrontation or conflict. So what will be different under this new model of relations? As they seek to define this new model, both countries and their peoples have to be realistic. The new model will not mean that either country is going to surrender its national interests to the other or give in on every issue. The two nations will continue in some cases to have different interests. They will sometimes disagree. Each will continue to do things the other will not like. They will continue to compete for markets, resources, and influence in the Asia Pacific and around the globe. They will continue to hedge against potential adverse behavior of the other. And the United States will continue to champion human rights, freedom, and democracy because it believes they offer a better life and produce more stable societies in the long run. But there will be a difference. If China and the United States achieve a new model of relations, cooperation will be its dominant element. The two countries will work together with other nations to solve the global challenges we all face. The two countries will try to manage their differences and ensure that they do not derail cooperation or drive the relationship into confrontation or conflict, especially military conflict. The two nations need to develop a few high-profile cooperative programs of common interest to both countries. This will show that there really is a new model of relations between the two countries and that it provides tangible benefits to both peoples. And we can talk at the break what some of those things might be. But while working on cooperative projects that will show the promise of the relationship, the two countries cannot ignore the problems in the relationship. The two governments must show that they can cooperate not only in meeting global challenges, but also in resolving bilateral disputes. They need to identify a couple bilateral disputes now that are ripe for resolution and make a concerted effort to solve them. This will also demonstrate to their two peoples that there is indeed a new model of relations. What are the potential barriers to achieving the new model of relations, and what could cause it to fail? Well, the list is pretty long. A severe economic downturn in one or both countries. To reduce this risk, the two countries need to help each other achieve their respective economic reform programs and thereby contribute to each other's economic success. Second factor would be a confrontation or conflict between Chinese and American military forces, particularly their naval forces, in and around the Asia Pacific. To reduce this risk, there needs to be greater transparency about the military plans and capabilities of both nations, more military-to-military exchanges, and opportunities for their naval forces to cooperate together to build greater trust and confidence. A failure to convince their respective publics that the new model is in the interest of both nations would doom it to failure. This is why the two nations need to pursue a few bold, high-profile cooperative projects and to cooperate in one or two of the long-standing bilateral disputes to show there are tangible benefits from the new relationship to both Chinese and American peoples. But more fundamentally, the two nations need to answer some hard questions about their relationship. Only if they get clarity on these fundamental questions can the two countries expect to make progress toward fashioning a new model of relations. For China, it needs to answer three questions for itself. Does China really want America out of the Asia Pacific? In a speech in Shanghai last spring, President Xi is reported to have said, "Security in Asia should be maintained by Asians themselves." And this statement was read as rather pointedly excluding the United States from any Asian security architecture. Is that what China really wants? Second question, does China think it can improve its relations with its neighbors while at the same time increasing the economic, diplomatic, and military pressure on them to give up their territorial claims or compromise their interests? And third, does China believe that the existing international framework that emerged after the end of World War II, the United Nations, the global financial institutions, the international legal structures, does China believe these disserve China's interests and need to be overturned? I would hope that China and most of its people would decide that the answer to these three questions is no. And here's why. The American military presence in Asia has been a stabilizing force, reassuring China's neighbors that they need not feel threatened by China's rising economic and military power, and helping to create the stable international environment that China itself says it needs in order to achieve its ambitious development goals. Take away that reassuring presence, and China runs the risk that its neighbors will increasingly band together against it. Indeed, China runs the risk of creating the very containment strategy undertaken by its own neighbors in response to its actions that many Chinese believe is the American strategy toward China in the first place. As to the second question, China's reaction to the competing territorial claims of its neighbors seems to have changed from one of reactive assertiveness to what might be called proactive assertiveness, taking the initiative to put pressure on its smaller neighbors to abandon their claims in the South China Sea or the East China Sea. This has led several of China's neighbors to reach out to the United States for diplomatic support and to invite and facilitate an expanded U.S. military presence in Asia. To the extent this is a result that China does not want, it suggests that China needs to take additional steps to reassure its neighbors of its good intentions and to stop bullying them. As to the third question, I hope that China will conclude that the institutions of global governance established since World War II have in fact provided a framework that has facilitated China's remarkable rise. China, therefore, has a stake in maintaining those institutions. It is right to insist that its role in these institutions reflect its increased weight in the international community. But this increased rate will come with increased responsibility, and that will be to improve the performance of these institutions and their positive contribution to global peace and prosperity for all nations. This is where I think we all want China to come out on these three questions. But it will get there only after a rich, intensive strategic conversation focused on these three questions. Such a conversation must be conducted between the two leaders of China and the United States and their trusted agents. The Sunnyland summit between President Obama and President Xi was a good start, but it was well over a year, almost 18 months ago. That won't do the trick. What is needed is a sustained, intensive, days-long conversation among the same small group of people on both sides every 3 months or so. And that said, I would urge Australia's leaders to conduct their own separate high-level strategic conversation with Chinese leaders on these same questions. Because of its close ties to China and its strong alliance relationship with the United States, Australia is in a unique position to help Chinese leaders better understand their strategic interests and come to the right answers to the three questions posed above. But to reach the mutual understanding required for a new model of relations with China, the United States and Australia must be prepared to answer the hard questions China is posing to us. One, are we ready to accept an increasingly powerful China playing an enhanced role on the world stage, perhaps ultimately a role on a par with that played by the United States itself? Two, are we ready to accept that as China's economy grows, it will build a larger, more capable ocean-going navy, able to protect the sea lanes from which China receives the energy, resources, and global trade on which it increasingly depends? And finally, are we willing to counsel restraint to our friends and allies in the Asia-Pacific region and urge them to make serious efforts to find a compromise with China on issues where China feels strongly that its interests are threatened? I would hope that most Australians and Americans would decide that the answer to these three questions is basically yes. As to the first question, the United States has been a strong supporter of China's entry onto the world stage. China's dramatic economic growth has been fueled in significant part by Western investment in China and China's exports to our countries. But more to the point, the global challenges that threaten virtually every nation on the planet can only be solved with the participation of China. So the world needs China to play an active, constructive role on the world stage. As to the second question, a growing Chinese open ocean naval capability can be of significant benefit if China is willing to share some of the responsibility for defending the sea lanes that has up to now fallen largely to Western navies. What we need is greater transparency about China's naval capabilities to give us confidence that sea lane protection is indeed the purpose of its naval expansion. Naval expansion that seems directed at giving China the capability of excluding the United States from the Asia Pacific will give rise to great suspicion and concern, not only among the American people, but also among most of China's neighbors. And as to the third question, many Chinese see behind every dispute and every challenge from one of its neighbors an American plot to create trouble for China. Many believe that if America were not present in the Asia Pacific, it would have fewer disputes with its neighbors. I think just the opposite. But for this reason, it behooves both the United States and Australia to use their influence to encourage the resolution of disputes between China and its neighbors on a reasonable and peaceful basis. This is the more hopeful new model of relations between China and the United States. More troubling is the new model of relations that Vladimir Putin seems intent on fashioning between Russia on the one hand and Western Europe and the United States on the other. I worry that President Putin, in his private conversations with President Xi Jinping, is making something like the following argument. Don't trust the Americans. The West does not accept the legitimacy of either the Russian or the Chinese regimes. The West, led by the United States, is seeking to destabilize and change both governments. I think Putin is suggesting that it is this effort that is responsible for the instability and demonstrations in both Ukraine and Hong Kong. I fear that Putin is telling Xi that the agents of this Western effort are civil society groups, NGOs, free media, and dissidents, and that these agents of foreign influence must be stamped out in both Russia and China. And I worry that he's saying that the United States and his allies need to be confronted at nearly every turn. And support for this worry of mine, and that it is not a fanciful concern, can be found in the fact that Chinese authorities seem to be adopting some of the same tactics against NGOs, the media, and dissidents that President Putin is using in Russia. And we are seeing increasingly aggressive actions being taken by both countries against Western nations. I hope that I'm wrong about this speculation. I think it would be a real mistake for China to go down this road. Its economic ties with Russia, while expanding, are still tiny compared to the trade and investment relationship China has with Europe and the United States. And going down the road of confrontation that President Putin seems to be pursuing would not just jeopardize President Xi Jinping's hopes for a new model of relations with the West, it would also jeopardize the realization of the economic reform program on which his legacy and the future prosperity and stability of China depends. So let's get working on the more constructive new model of China-U.S. relations. And on this, as in on so much else, Australia has an important role to play. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's customary for the person in my position to say that was a rich speech, but I think it was not just a rich speech, it was an important one. It was compelling, it was hopeful, it was balanced. And you were making a powerful argument for a new kind of modus vivendi between Beijing and Washington. We have about 20 minutes for questions, and I'm going to kick off with two questions, if I can, just to kind of frame the debate. One about the US-China relationship and one about the US-China-Australia strategic triangle. First of all, on the bilateral relationship, all of us hope that the kind of new model you've sketched out eventuates. But let me ask you, as someone who's stood at the right hand of a president and has to think about the worst case scenarios, what are the chances of this eventuating? And here I'm thinking both of the structural dynamics, the two bulls in the one paddock metaphor, but also the leaders on both sides. Perhaps you can talk to us a bit about to what extent are US leaders likely to be up for these kinds of accommodations and compromises, and also Xi Jinping, the most powerful Chinese leader since Deng Xiaoping, a hard man, even harder than most Chinese presidents, who's hardening up internal security, who's hardening up external Chinese foreign policy. How likely, to what extent are American and Chinese leaders up for the kind of new model that you describe?
Is it going to be hard? You bet. It in some sense requires one to put hope over experience, because the historical precedents go in the other direction. The reason for making the effort is because it is so much in the interest, I think, both of China and the United States, and the consequences for both countries, for Australia, the rest of the region, indeed the world, are grave if these two powers, in fact, come into confrontation and conflict. So it's clearly worth the effort. For the reasons I suggested, it is not hopeless. I think there is an opportunity here. I think the two leaders would want to do it, and in some sense, the strength of Xi Jinping that you referred to puts him in a position to be able to, in some sense, impose his will on the bureaucracy and drag some of the people in the Chinese system in this direction, if he can be convinced to do so. But we've got to get to him early. He is, you know, almost 2 years into a 10-year term. He's learning every day. We need to have him learn the right lessons. We need to get him hooked into the effort to try to make this vision a reality, Because if we don't do it now, by the time he's in year 6, 7, and 8 of his presidency, he's going to be in a different wicket, and he'll be much more difficult to handle, much more difficult to handle. I think President Obama wants to try this. I think if you get the best, whoever is elected in 2016 is liable to be a fairly centrist Republican or Democrat, and either way, I think they will try to pick up this baton. China policy has been an area where there's been great continuity in U.S. policy across 7 presidents, Republican and Democrat. I think that will continue. So I think it is possible and certainly worth the effort. And I think the U.S. president, both now and in the future, will make that effort.
Thank you. Let me ask you about this triangle between Canberra, Beijing, and Washington. Australian public opinion is very interesting on this. As you and I have discussed, the Lowy Institute, most consistent finding of the Lowy Institute poll over 10 years has been the support for the US alliance, the belief that it's important to our security. Australian opinion on China is much more bifurcated. On the one hand, Australians feel warmer towards China than they have in a long way. They know that China contributes to Australian GDP growth. On the other hand, as our poll this year found, nearly half of Australians think Australia will be in a military conflict with China in the next 2 decades. That's an incredible correlation of findings. Half of us think that we will be in a military conflict with our leading trading partner in 2 decades. And I think that's partly explained by, as we were discussing today, by the unevenness of Chinese behaviour and the uncertainty around it. So let me just ask you this. You've been in Australia now for a couple of weeks. What are your observations about how Australia is managing these two axes of the triangle? Do you think the Abbott government is mainly getting it right or mainly getting it wrong?
I think they're doing pretty well. And I think that public opinion poll you showed, in some sense, sets the challenge. Because in some sense, managing China, we're going to have to do 2 things at the same time that seem inconsistent. On the one hand, we're going to have to reach out and engage China, see if we can get it to work cooperatively to solve some of these global challenges I spoke about. And at the same time, we need to be drawing some lines for China and insisting on certain norms of behavior that make clear we are not going to allow China to convert its enormous economic and increasing military power into a capacity to bully its neighbors, to use the threat of military force to achieve national or territorial objectives. So it's what the Americans used to call, it's the tough love syndrome. It's requiring to do 2 things at once. And I think the Abbott government is off to a good start. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about this infrastructure bank that China has proposed. And my interpretation of what the Abbott government has done, and it's only mine and I'm an outsider, is that they've said, yes, we'd like to do this. We're not going to reject it out of hand because it's been proposed by China. We recognize China could make an enormous contribution to building infrastructure in a transparent, non-corrupt way in this region. But that is the point, after all. The second half is to say, but we need more details. We need to know what the governance structure is going to be. What are the standards going to be applied? Is it going to be transparent? Is it going to be non-corrupt? Is it really going to be directed towards building infrastructure the region needs? Or is this just a thinly disguised device for Chinese foreign policy to advance its interests at the expense of the rest of the country in the region? I think that's not a bad framing. Outreach to China, but at the same time, setting some rules of the road for dealing with China. It's going to be very hard. It's going to require sustained focus across administrations. But I think from what I've seen, the Australian public and the Australian leaders get it. in terms of what we're going to need if we're going to manage the emerging China.
Just to follow up on that on the bank question quickly, how would you respond to the critics of the decision who say, for years we've been saying that China needs to be a responsible stakeholder, as you said, an active and constructive player. Here they come, they want to contribute. We all need infrastructure, we all need more funds to get jobs and growth and raise people's quality of life. And here, almost at the first hurdle, we say, no, we're not going over the hurdle with you.
But that's the point. Australia did not say, no, we're not going over the hurdle with you. It actually said just what you said. We want to know that this is something where China is behaving as a responsible stakeholder, not China behaving as a self-interested great power, trying to create a device that is, in fact, not a multilateral institution to do investment in a responsible way, but a device to advance China's foreign policy. So I think that's exactly the point they've made. Yes, we're willing to do it if it is an example of China as a responsible stakeholder, not as China as a regional hegemon. That's a reasonable thing to ask.
Right. I don't want to hog this for too long. So who would like to ask a question to Mr. Hadley? I'm going to ask questioners to identify themselves before they ask their question.
Yes, Alan Dupont from the Lowy Institute and University of New South Wales. Steve, I'd like to just take you back to some of the comments you made about China being a responsible stakeholder. The Chinese response to that would be, well, do you mean by responsible stakeholder a country that's going to support essentially Western institutions and norms, some of which we don't agree with? And if it's not that, then what is it? So I guess my question to you is that China may be operating in a bit of a parallel universe to the one that you've described. And while I applaud your constructive vision for a new Sino-US relationship, if you look at Chinese behaviour rather than, you know, what they do rather than what they say, take the South China Sea as one example, it's pretty clear to me that China is pursuing a policy of what we might call muscular unilateralism or coercion of one kind or another in the East China and South China Seas. So my question to you really is, that being the case, and that it seems that China is adhering to its own set of norms, which are different from the ones that you've described or the ones that you wanted to sign up to, what would the US do if it felt that Chinese behaviour, for example, in the South China Sea, is contrary not only to US interests, but to the norms which you've set out, which I believe it is at the moment? So what is the hard power? Is there a hard power response? If so, what is it?
Yeah, you know, I've never used the phrase responsible stakeholder, and it does not appear in my speech. And one of the problems in dealing with China is, you know, it's very easy to set things as to either or. And my experience in policy is things are never either or. They're always some of both and two or three other things that you didn't think about. So I think you cannot say, well, the Chinese behavior in the South China Sea tells you everything you need to know about Chinese behavior in every sphere around the globe. It's much more a mixed picture. And interestingly enough, I think China has largely accepted the international institutions. It wanted to get into the WTO. It plays in the G20. It plays in the talks with the Iranians. They have largely accepted these structures. What they have said is the world has changed. We are emerging. We ought to have greater weight in these structures. And one of the things that's unfortunate is my own government has been slow to respond to that reasonable request. And I think that's one of the failure, for example, to rebalance, if you will, the voting shares in the IMF, I think is one of the things, it may be just a pretext, but I think it's one of the things that is behind what China has done with this investment bank. If you won't let me have a reasonable share of influence in the institutions that are now established, I'll go establish my own. And that will be a temptation, and I think we need to be responsive to it and try to convince China that this existing structure has served China well, and it has. if you look at the meteoric rise that they have done. So how do we signal with respect to the South China Sea? I think in some sense, she's under a lot of pressure, as any leader is, to be tough on sovereignty and to be tough on his territorial claims. And he's making a lot of enemies in China with his anti-corruption program, and of course the best way to go after a leader is to challenge them on the grounds that they're not sensitive enough and assertive enough about territorial claims. So he's got a lot of domestic pressure to push out, and we have to create some pressure to push back. And I think there's three elements of that. One is we've got to consult, and it's got to be not just the United States, not just Australia. It's got to be China's neighbors as a whole, taking action and responding. There cannot be free riders here. Everybody's got to be in on the drill. Secondly, I think in terms of the military, we have to recognize that China's military will get bigger, and we probably cannot stop that. But we should not cede the field, and it means our military capabilities need to go up as well. And thirdly, the hardest piece of it is we have to somehow get the message across to Xi Jinping that if he pushes out on things like the East China Sea or the South China Sea, he's going to alienate his neighbors, his major trading partners. It will have economic consequences for China as well as for us, and he will not be able to realize his economic objectives for his country and his economic reform program. And that means stability of the Chinese system and legacy for him in terms of what he set as his objectives of his 10-year term. So I think there are instruments there. I think we've seen some response to Xi and in the pushback we have made in terms of the East China Sea and South China Sea, probably not enough. It's going to be very hard. But we are not without instruments. But I think we have to be in a position of pushing back, establishing clear lines, being consistent about those lines. And when the Chinese try to press us collectively or individually, standing firm. Because my experience with the Chinese is that if you give in to Chinese pressure, you only get one thing, and that's a lot more pressure.
Fred Woollard, one country you didn't mention in your speech, which has historically been a cause of anxiety between America and China, is Taiwan. It's been quiet for several years. Do you expect it to continue to be quiet?
I think it will. I'm not as close a Taiwan watcher as I should be. We had a difficult time with Chen Shui-bian when he was president, and the prospect that he would declare independence and what that would do to stability in the region. We got through that. I think the Ma administration has been trying to reach out to China to establish a good economic ties to begin to make some progress on some of the security issues. I think as long as it pursues that course of action, it'll probably be quiet. The real question, of course, will be next election and what attitude the opposition party will take to President Ma's initiatives. And at this point, I think it's too soon to tell.
Yes, sir. Just wait for the microphone, if you would.
Thank you. My name's Brian Padman. I'm a long-standing citizen. I'd like to get some idea of where you see trade fitting into the whole picture, because the environment seems to me to be insidiously changing. We've had our manufacturing industries totally decimated, and China is, of course, investing in our companies. They're doing this in other parts of the world. I understand they've done a lot in Africa. So that in the end, they've got tentacles that, whether you like it or not, are making a vast change to your position, and some of the means of retreat are very difficult. the politicians tell us that free trade is the way to go. As somebody who's had a career in manufacturing, I find that a very difficult proposition.
Can you come to the question, sir?
Yes, the question is that trade is playing a big part. The scene that you're talking about is changing slowly but surely under the surface. And I just think that we're going to see immense change in that area, and trade, I think, is important, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on that general matter.
It's very important. Trade has caused exactly the kinds of dislocations you have described, but it also has been responsible to an enormous amount of economic growth in the region and in the United States. So it's like so many things, it's a two-edged sword. Investment, you know, last decade into the, you know, all the news was about Western investment in China. The news of this decade is China investment looking outward. China is investing more in the United States today than the United States is investing in China. This is unheard of. On one level, that is good because we need investment. We need to rebuild the infrastructure in the United States. This whole region needs more infrastructure. And if China would play a responsible role in that, that could be a good thing. I think what we need, though, is a framework for trade investment relations that has some high standards and tries to address some of the problems you've identified. And that's why this Trans-Pacific Partnership that was a Bush administration initiative that the Obama administration is pursuing is so important, because it is a WTO plus agreement, a very high standards trade agreement. And if we can get that in place in the region, then we are in a position to talk to China about a more global framework, or a broader regional framework for trade and investment that would meet the kind of standards it needs to meet if it is going to provide a level playing field in terms of trade. That is, I think, what the Obama administration has in mind. I think it's really important strategically as part of an effort to manage the emergence of China. And I hope it gets done, and I hope it gets done this year. And I think if it does, I think Congress, in the end of the day, after a lot of strung and drawing, will pass it. And in that respect, it looks like the Republicans have captured control of the Senate, and that actually may be a good thing for the trade promotion authority that would be needed to be put in place in order to approve a TPP agreement.
Can I ask you, Steve, when we think about this issue, the U.S., how the U.S. treats China, how it thinks about TPP and so on, obviously the United States faces challenges, and the U.S. order faces challenges around the world at the moment. You mentioned Mr. Putin's attempt to rewrite the rule book in Europe. We haven't discussed the Middle East. You addressed that at a speech a couple of days ago, but you have the black-flagged armies of the Islamic State on the march, and you have a pretty depressing outlook, actually, throughout the Middle East. Does this make it harder or easier for US leaders to come to the kind of modus vivendi with China that you're speaking of? One can imagine it making it harder in the sense that they're distracted, they're focused on so many other things that they can't bring the kind of subtlety to the China issue that it deserves. One can also imagine it making it easier because, in a sense, maybe some of the military elements of the challenges elsewhere in the world, for example, in the Middle East, will make it less likely that there'd be a sort of a hardline martial response to China. So does the widespread and diverse nature of the global challenges make it harder or easier for American leaders to do this?
Not sure. It's a good question. Certainly, one of the challenges, it's a very crowded agenda as you start ticking off all the things, all the pots that are boiling over on the stove. One brief story. Brent Scowcroft was National Security Advisor under both Gerald Ford and President George H.W. Bush. And he was describing the difference between his world and the world today. And he said, you know, when I was national security advisor, we, at any point in time, we had one big thing, which was manage the Soviet Union, and one small thing, a crisis here or there. But now I describe it, what Susan Rice is doing, she's cooking on a 9-burner stove. Every burner has a pot, and every pot is about to boil over. And the risk is that all she does is run from pot to pot, stirring them and keeping the boil over at a minimum. So it is a very crowded agenda, and it's very tough to get out of crisis mode and be strategic and put in place things like TPP that are actually going to avoid crises in the future and help you handle things. But there is no substitute. You just got to do it. It is the world we face today. I think the risk is that for the United States, sort of credibility and consistency is the coin of the realm. And I think the real problem is that the whole world is watching everything going on everywhere. And if we cannot manage President Putin's challenge with respect to Ukraine, if we cannot manage the Islamic State challenge in the Middle East, I worry that President Xi Jinping thinks, you know, the Americans don't really have what it takes. And he has less of an incentive to try to deal with this and work with us to the kind of stable regime we need in Asia if we're going to handle the rise of China. So I think one of the problems is a little bit like, you know, a 10-round boxing. I know boxing, I'm not sure they do much boxing in Australia, but in any event, it's like a 10-round event, and you've got to win every round. That's really the problem. We've got to be seen to be succeeding against Putin in Ukraine, to be succeeding in IS in order to be credible with Xi Jinping when it comes time to start drawing lines and insisting that there are rules that he has to respect. I think that's the problem for us.
Ladies and gentlemen, there have been many hands up. I haven't got to everybody, but we always finish on time at the Institute. I think it's been a treat tonight to hear from Steve Hadley. I can imagine few people that I'd prefer to be standing at the 9-burner stove, keeping all the pots from boiling over and making sure that the big pots on the big flame and the little pots on the little flame, which is where I always get it wrong. I did hear one point today that I thought was really, many points that were interesting, but one that I thought was really novel and really hopeful. You know that there's that that cliche, really, in US politics, that it's only guys who are really, really tough and hard on issues that can suddenly be soft. And the argument goes that it was only Richard Nixon who could go to China. And Steve made a really important point, which is that maybe only Xi Jinping can go to America. Maybe Xi Jinping is only hard enough and tough enough and credible to strike this kind of modus vivendi. I certainly hope that's the case. Can I thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming this evening? Can I make a special thanks to Owen Harries, in whose lecture, in whose honour Steve spoke tonight, and to Dorothy Harries? And can I ask you please to join me in thanking our distinguished international fellow and our Harries lecturer for 2014, Steve Hadley.